Hello, and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm your host, Thomas Hill. Our guest today is Charles Henry, Vice Provost and University Librarian at Rice University, who is leading a venture to resurrect Rice University Press as the first academic publishing house to publish scholarly books exclusively in digital form. Welcome, Chuck.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here today.
It's good to talk after, what has it been, 5 years since the dedication of the new wing of the Vassar Library?
I think it has been 5 years, five summers, yeah.
Rice University Press was closed down in 1996 as a result of what was even 10 years ago being called a crisis in academic publishing, and in the publishing of scholarly monographs in particular, that is, books written by an individual scholar on a single subject. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about the crisis and the economics of academic publishing in general.
Sure. One of the earlier articles came out in the Chronicle of Higher Education, I think in 1995, Stanford Thatcher's, I think it was called The Crisis in Scholarly Publishing, and it was one of the first articles to raise the question of really confronting what he termed the crisis that wasn't at the time so widely recognized. Then and now, basically, that the costs of printing a book, of publishing a printed book, were and are very high. And this was concomitantly woven into a period where library budgets in particular were declining for a number of years and have continued to decline since then. So the presses were faced with the problem of rising costs and dwindling markets. And the dwindling markets then raised the cost of printing a book if they were going to have fewer and fewer volumes in their run, fewer copies. It's just going to spiral like that. So
it is a vicious circle.
Yeah, it really is. And it's one that we haven't dug our way out of yet. So with a reduced market and ever-increasing costs, the real problem is, one, that books are expensive. But I think more importantly, that there are now much, much fewer opportunities for particularly younger scholars to publish. The presses, in response to the high prices, the high cost of printing, and the reduced market, have reduced the number of titles per year in humanities pretty much across the board. And I think what had begun as serious economic constraints has become much more of a cultural issue. The intellectual progress, the intellectual advancement of a particular discipline is now constrained in certain ways by the culture of the book. The Rice Press closed around 1996, basically in response to these conditions. It was losing money, and its focus, its scholarly focus, was a bit diffuse at the time, and it was considered just not tenable to continue to subsidize the press. It's interesting, going back to Thatcher's article over 10 years ago, the solution that he was promoting at the time was increased subvention by universities for the presses. You can read about that now for the last 10 years, and as recently as publications that came out from ACLS in 2003 and 2004 arguing for the same. So the Rice Press is basically in response to this crisis, but with putting up a very different model.
So can you tell us about the new Rice University Press and how it will address the problems that threaten the future of the scholarly monograph and that helped cause the demise of the old Rice University Press?
I guess one way to describe it is to look at the Rice University Press as parcel with other 21st century business ventures, in the sense that a lot, if not most, of the traditional aspects of a university press have been unbundled. So what Rice Press is doing is soliciting manuscripts digitally, having a very rigorous peer review, and then publishing the final version, the approved version, in various representations on a server. And that's what we do. We've contracted with Coop, Q-O-O-P, which is a print-on-demand. Coop takes care of the physical printing of the book. The book can come out as a paperback, it can come out as a hardback, it can come out as a leather-bound embossed book, if you'd like. Coop has all those capabilities, but it's up to the end user. So once the book is published by the press, by Rice Press, then it's up to the individual, whether it's a library or a scholar or a student, to have the book printed and then delivered to her or his home. And this way, the savings are actually enormous. There's no warehouse. There's no backlog. There's nothing in print in the sense of our books are digital, so there's nothing out of print either. And by being able to print on demand, the cost of each printed volume is just a fraction of what it would cost to produce a run of, say, 1,000 books, of which 300 might sell. So that's basically the model. So the financials, the printing, anything that has to do with a physical object has been unbundled and offloaded to another company, basically, at tremendous savings.
You are quoted in an early press release that you estimate startup costs for the operation will be 1/10 of the cost of a conventional printing operation. But since most of the cost of producing the average book aren't in printing and distribution, but in refereeing, editing, marketing, and markup, how much do you realistically expect to save on overhead once you're up and running?
Our main cost in that regard is the editor-in-chief, and we hope to hire someone in the next couple of weeks. We've located this fellow in Seattle who is just terrific. So there'll be cost for his services, certainly, but he doesn't have to leave Seattle. So the overhead cost of office and lease space, we wouldn't incur that.
So no bricks and mortar.
Yeah, there's no brick and mortar involved in this at all. The content management, the markup, all of that is done through connections, Project at Rice. And that another aspect of our overhead is a part-time person, at least in the beginning, who will be doing the markup, the formatting of the text, the formatting of the book, might be text, might be multimedia. But a lot of that is also automated. So there's actually very little costs involved in doing that. To give you an example, once a manuscript goes through the peer review process, has been approved by the editor, the author's happy, and the peer review board says this is really first-rate, publish it. Because of the automatic markup and the ability of running this book, say, through Connections platform, the book is up in 3 days, as opposed to 6 months or a year. Then once it comes up, say, 3 days after approval or a week after approval, it can be printed immediately upon appearance. So for the author, it's a very, very quick turnaround. And again, with a significant reduction in cost.
So who is responsible for reproduction rights?
We want to work with the author on that. Because we're going to be working with probably art history and architectural history in the beginning, that's an issue. We have staff who could do that. A lot of times, more and more, let's say, a number of the images are often taken by the author, the use of digital cameras and digital photography and all of that. But where copyright approval is required, our intent is to work with the author to secure that.
In the peer review process, will you pay faculty for vetting and reading manuscripts, or is this a cost the Academy could legitimately ask faculty to bear as personally as part of their peer review activities?
The faculty I've spoken to have indicated that they would do this without charge because they would like to see this press succeed. If there's a time where compensation for the peer review panels is required, then we would step up to that. But for the time being, I think that this is considered to be an experiment. The most important aspect of it, I think the technology is fairly straightforward, is the peer review. And that has to be as rigorous as any other existing press. If we slack on that, if we fall short on a kind of a lack of intellectual acumen, or if anything that comes out of this press is perceived as second rate, we basically lose the game. So that's really where the focus is right now.
Yes, I expect it's very important to get this right, since you must be aware that you'll be up against a sentiment that will tend, at first at least, to want to regard the electronic monograph as what happens to manuscripts that aren't good enough to make it in the print world.
And I hear that argument. If you step back from it, there's no reason that the Rice Press, for any reason, has to appear second rate or second tier. Again, I think it has to do with the kind of people that are attracted to the Board of Governors and especially to the peer review panels. The other side of this multifaceted coin, of course, is that because Connections, because the Rice Press can very easily produce and publish multimedia works, that scholars who are interested in working in different methodologies, working on different intellectual strategies for their publications, in certain ways interested in creating new means of argument, new kinds of arguments, will have a much easier way of expressing that in something like the model of the Rice Press, because sound and images and moving images and text can all be very elegantly combined. So on the one hand, there may be some resistance to this. On the other hand, I think some of the more inventive scholars would be quite attracted to this. The problem, or the question is, will those who publish in this press get academic credit for it? And I think that, to me, is a fundamental question. In my conversations with deans and representatives of scholarly societies and scholars and department chairs, I can report that if, assuming that this press gets going and the works are considered, you know, major contributions to the intellectual dialogue, that there will not be any problem for anyone getting credit for this. There's a lot of conditions here, but...
It seems to me that once you start experimenting with the idea of the book itself and the way you're doing, you have to think about the larger context in which the book exists. Although we tend to think of books as individual independent objects, which of course they are, they are also, in fact, essential cogs in a larger apparatus, a machinery of thought and also memory, if you will, that includes libraries, of course, but that also encompasses the greater institution of education itself. So a change as dramatic as this in the way knowledge is formulated and channeled within the academy is logically going to have repercussions that will affect every facet of the way the quest for knowledge is conducted. And my question is, do you see yourself here as participating in a process to rethink the structure and function of how the academy itself operates by shaping the way faculty communicate?
I've certainly given that thought. My own bias is that I hope it does challenge the existing models. Well, let me quickly cite a very interesting historical work, The Nature of the Book. Adrian Johns, I think, several years ago came out. And it's a wonderful book because it talks at very great length and with rigorous scholarship about the appearance of the printed book, the original printed book, the Gutenberg Revolution. And it describes, particularly the first couple centuries, as a period of great chaos, great disregard for the book in certain ways, rampant piracy, bad editions coming out all the time. It was very, very difficult to trust anything that came out in print. And in fact, on the contrary, you know, it was highly suspect in certain cities, given the rampant theft and plagiarism of the printers. All of which is to say that our reception of the book today as a trusted and authoritative method of conveying knowledge is a construct that's been developed through social and cultural series of interpretations for centuries. So the high regard and the privilege, let's say, that we give to the printed book today did not come about with its appearance in Western civilization. It came about through centuries of modifications and the development of different reading strategies. I look at a digital model in the same way, that many of the issues of piracy and authenticity and authority and what is true versioning and basic security are very, very similar to 16th century discussion. But I think actually here we're on much firmer ground, and I think that I really do.
I wonder if your being a medievalist makes you less invested in print than your colleagues might be, for instance. And as a medievalist, with a sense of just what was lost in our own once upon a time highly nuanced understanding of the true potential of the book as a cognitive space and multimedia sensorium, if you will, before the illuminated manuscript page was replaced by the printed page, do you ever wonder if we might actually be entering upon a sea change in the way we conceive of the world in the digital era? That is, we change the apparatus of cognition with something truly different from the printed page. Will we change the way we think about things?
I think that's a great question, and the answer is, being a medievalist, yeah, I've always appreciated, in fact, have recently taught courses on medieval art and literature with an art historian at Rice, and you know, the richness of the representations coming out of the manuscript era was just astonishing. And it's something that the present technology can, I think, capture and build upon in ways that the printed book could not, and particularly with the constraints of cost and production models that we're living with now that constrain the very kinds of expression that entail these different media, whether it's text or moving images or you know, beautiful, vibrant, high-resolution images that are so expensive to produce in physical form.
Well, certainly the web offers a more fluid medium than the printed page for developing different ways of thinking. And I did take a look at Connections, Rice's web-based learning instrument on the web there, and it itself is a very fluid medium.
Yeah, it's very much a web-based form of teaching in the true sense of the web, breaking up modules creating modules that can be cross-linked in any variety of ways. But it also, there's a couple of courses you may have seen on Connections that are music theory, and where you can actually hear the music, it's embedded in the text, and you can take a particular theme and see what Irving Berlin did to it or Aaron Copland did to it and compare and contrast there through audio files. It provides, it seems to me, a more profound engagement with the subject matter on the one hand, and on the other, it allows you to test some of the assumptions of the professor or the author. And I think that's one of the advantages of a digital publication, is that you can link much more easily to the research behind it and to the recreations of those representations that the author is referring to much more easily. So it actually brings you closer to the scholarly process, I think, than the written book can approximate.
Now, just to be clear about this, you're not talking here about Rice University Press providing digitized representations of printed works, in essence, pictures of the pages of books, the way many presses already do for certain of their publications, and the way Google has undertaken to do in a big way with the combined holdings of the libraries of Oxford, Stanford, the University of Michigan, etc. But you're intending to publish works that may eventually be printed by people who purchase them, but where the original bona fide document is the electronic one, is that correct?
That's exactly right. And I think that there may be a variety of representations which would include a PDF, you know, as an option if that's what someone wanted, but the original version is a digital, I hesitate to call it a book, as a sort of received terms, but it's a digital object, and the original version of which will be on a secure server and all of that. But the books themselves, the objects themselves, will be, if the author wishes, you know, they could become part of Connections. So chapters could become modules, or subchapters become part of the course that someone's using in Madrid. Another aspect of this, I guess, quickly, is that once you get into a digital environment, then that environment becomes much more of a place for research and for teaching, and the boundary between teaching and research becomes much more porous.
Well, this, it seems to me, has implications that go beyond those of these other projects, not the least of which is that your original document has no set form. It's a kind of intangible or liquid that can be poured into various forms or containers depending upon the way the document's markup language is interpreted by the software that translates it. So what is the original?
That's a great question. I guess the phenomenon that you're well familiar with, Incunabula, and the original Gutenberg press publications tried very hard to look like manuscripts. And some of the early ones actually had the manuscript cursive print replicated, and also some of them were people would actually go in and illustrate, so they look very much like manuscripts. I think that for the time being, there will be an Incunabula stage here, in the sense that going off and producing a liquid object would probably be moving too quickly. But my guess would be there would be elements of a traditional bound book, such as page numbers and means by which to organize the argument. At the same time, embedded in this would be different kinds of, let's say, new resources and new methods of interpolation.
And relatedly, with respect to the lack of tangibility of the electronic text, do you propose to fix the text at all in terms of time? Will you limit the frequency of and track revised editions, which an author could theoretically make on a daily or even hourly basis? When a text is changed, will it be subject to further review?
Good. Another great question. The author will have a copyright. Will own the copyright. So the author really does have free access to his or her book. What we have as an aspect of access and security, that there will be a version that will be called number one. And if the author comes in and wants to revise a week later or 2 months later, then that will become version two, and there will be a place within the object that will show what the author changed and when. So if someone wants to go back to the original first edition, let's say, that will be available, and then there might be 15 editions. If the author is somewhat eccentric and comes back every other day and makes relatively minor changes, that will be tracked. And that says something about the author, I would think. But I think that one would count on the responsibility of the author to make this a reasonable process. But I'd also add that one of the features that we want to get up and running quickly would be conversation spaces or monitored blogs or some kind of place where faculty and students using this book can actually communicate directly with the author. And what I'm hoping this allows is that a book gets published, it gets put on the shelf, and it's, other than a handful of reviews or perhaps a number of sales, an author really doesn't know much about how his or her book or this research work is interpolated or used in classes. I'm hoping to get more and more students as well as faculty involved in the process of follow-up and to say, you know, Professor X, Chapter 1 was terrific. We had a great discussion today. Your argument in Chapter 2 isn't very clear. Some students might come in and say, yeah, well, I found this difficult for these reasons. That's a kind of communication that doesn't exist in this current physical model of published books and solid brick-and-mortar libraries. I don't know if it'll make a big difference, but it might make some difference. But it will at least invigorate a conversation or a dialogue that may, in fact, be quite beneficial to the author over time.
Interesting. Digital texts are, to most people, rather difficult to read on the screen at this point in time, although habit, of course, enters into this to some extent. I notice undergraduates seem to be a lot more comfortable reading PDFs than I am myself, for instance. But it does seem to me that the people who design online readers like Acrobat and Preview are guilty of a pretty dramatic lack of imagination in the way they try to emulate the printed page, even to the point of emulating yellow highlighter capabilities without providing adequately for glossing, note-taking, and any kind of linking functionality that would really allow a reader to make a text their own. And I wonder if you see better tools for readers of electronic texts on the horizon.
Oh, sure. There's any number of existing toolkits that could be incorporated with a book, say a Digilogic, and the student downloads it onto a laptop or a desktop at some point. And then the student owns it, and the student can mark it up. That exists, and it's something that we would want to promote. It's not something that we'd want to roll out right away. But it's certainly consonant with the impetus behind the press to, in certain ways, foster just what you're talking about, greater ownership of an argument by the reader and not something that's simply passive. And a yellow line through selected text is a fairly passive response. Being able to dig more deeply into the research behind this particular digital object, let's say, or being able to link directly to other works by the author or works that the author cites or research data or whatever behind it. Or say, if it's an art history book, linking more directly into some of the larger image databases to make more comparisons or contrasts with images in a related period. All that is stimulating. And when I see undergraduates in particular work, they hop around a lot. And it's not frivolous hopping. I mean, they're often looking around, they're testing assumptions. Even if they're at a lecture and they bring a laptop with them and someone's talking about a particular author or a particular work or a particular phenomenon, it's likely the students are going to start punching around and calling these up. It's on the one hand distracting, and on the other hand, it's reaffirming. It's that kind of multifaceted response to an argument that we would like to inculcate. And how we do that down the road, I don't know, but that's the general force of all this.
I didn't ask before when we were talking about the economics of your new system. Will these works be less expensive than your ordinary academic press monograph? And will ordinary scholars then be able to afford to access them? I mean, do you have an idea of how these things will be accessed?
Right now, the model we're working with is that the digital version will be available free for reading. We're contemplating a small charge for download of the digital version, and not sure about that. We may do that.
Not the usual $50 to $80, which is what academic monographs seem to cost now.
Oh, no, no, a few dollars. And then if the reader then wants to have this book printed, then there's a charge, you know, depending on whether it's a paperback or a hardback. However the reader wishes to configure the book or the final object, there'll be a scale of costs associated with that. But even so, a paperback book that might cost $60 or $65, we imagine would be made available for $15, something like that, a hardbound at a similar discount. And it's also important to realize that if, let's take a young art historian, fairly new to the field, say that art historian has written a very good book-length study, and there's typically a good deal of images that are requisite to the strength of the argument. A press, a good academic press, will review the manuscript and come back and say, this is really fine, and we want to publish it, but we're going to ask you to send us $2,500 because the book has to include images. Or one of the more recent ones that I saw on the web the other day that came across an email, rather, was $5,000 by Top Flight. $5,000 for a scholar starting out in a field in the humanities is a lot of money. Sometimes universities provide a subvention, sometimes departments do, or sometimes schools do. But it's not unusual to ask for what is, without question, a significant amount of money to publish this. Now, if the money isn't found, then the book will not get published. And then the question of who's paying for what, and there's an issue of quality and these kinds of things that naturally arise. In what we're setting up here is that there will never be any kind of subvention asked, and that the author will probably make some money. The objects will be available for printing, but at a much, much reduced cost. And so students can actually begin to afford these. If a student wants a paperback book, or just download it, even better, at basically next to nothing. But even if there's a small download charge, the author will get a royalty for that. So if you're publishing a book in the humanities and it may sell 500 copies or 300 copies, you actually have an audience here, I would think, of several thousand. Which goes back to the kind of market that was available back in the 80s before the prices got so steep and the library budgets began to tank. So, but anyway.
Most people may be unaware that scholarly authors only received really, if anything, nominal monetary compensation from publishers for what they write, except perhaps for textbook publishers, but that's another issue altogether. It's really a racket. And that a faculty member writing a book would be lucky to be able to pay the babysitter off and on the royalties that they receive for writing a book that may take them 20 years to research and produce.
Oh, yeah, and textbooks, that is a racket. Boy, that's, and it's actually a racket that's being explored from a lot of different angry directions at this point right now. One of the worst, you get a textbook that has these perforated pages for work study, for homework. And, of course, as soon as you write in them and tear them out, you need a new book the next year. So I think students are getting soaked by all of this, and there really are many far less expensive and efficacious ways to avoid this or to work around it. One thing, let me add just very quickly, this issue of revealing scholarship. One of the facets that's most interesting to me about the press at this point is now in conversation with several other university presses for bringing back a number of their out-of-print books. And the economic formulations in this is that you have a book that sold somewhat briskly, say, 10 years ago, and people still cite it, but it's out of print. And the presses figure, well, we probably couldn't sell too many of them, but certainly not enough to put it back into print again. So what we're doing is spinning off what we're calling the long tail press. And what we want to do is to partner with existing presses to bring back some of these more important out-of-print books that are just prohibitively expensive to bring out in print. So that's another facet of this. We're not competing with university presses, actually offering a way to bring to light, basically, some of these older works that are actually quite good but would not otherwise be available.
And these are books, I presume, that would still be under the protection of copyright.
Yeah, and that's the difference. For the most part, the presses own the copyright. And what we would do, what we're thinking of doing in these conversations, is it would be the long tail press. So it wouldn't be branded Rice University. It would be a neutral. And it would be, for example, Michigan University Press, powered by Long Tail Press or something like that. But it would have the benefit of then of being up and always up. If it's not in print, it's not out of print. It'd be there forever, basically. And then you'd have the opportunity to print it through Coop or another print on demand. But it would just be available. And I think that, again, the more that we can contribute to this scholarly environment, the richer it becomes as a source of research, too. So,
presumably, if you're able to sell directly to students and scholars at a nominal fee, there'll still be a place for libraries in this publishing picture, will there? I speak as, of course, a librarian, wondering about the future.
I would hope the library would be an important market. I think for the time, for the foreseeable future, let's say, that a bound book will certainly lose, in some cases, not all cases, but in some cases will lose the dynamic and linked aspects of a digital version. But I would think that there would be many libraries that might have both. There might be a version that's printed and then put on the shelf, as has been the tradition, and then maybe a digital copy available on a server somewhere. I think the market is going to be really mixed probably for 10 years or so. And because one of the reasons we were adamant about hooking up with and contracting with a print-on-demand company is we think that print is still deeply part of academe for very good reasons, and that option was not to be mitigated. So I think that it'll be a combination of wide, almost wild, a variety of combinations that will sort themselves out in a decade or so.
Yes, it sounds to me this is going to be the Wild West of academic publishing, I think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it is. And an existing enterprise that might be well studied by all of us involved in scholarly publications is the National Academies. And the National Academies has a really rich array of digital publications, print-on-demand publications, print publications. There's a really interesting choice, and that seems to work very well. It serves its constituency more than adequately, and people, for different reasons, will want a print version. They'll want a PDF that they can print on their printer at home, or they'll just want a digital version that they can plop on their screens. But it's nice. It's very thoughtful.
When I was asking you earlier about peer review, I forgot to ask a related question, which is, will independent scholars have equal access to the submissions process, and do you have any plans to vet contributed manuscripts anonymously, as some journals do? I ask because one very provocative benefit of your project, as well as of the great digitization projects I see going on in libraries across the world, is the potential for the cultivation of a host of independent amateur scholars as the whole universe of recorded knowledge becomes available to individual small libraries and localities in a way that would have been inconceivable only a few years ago. But in order for this potential to be truly realized, these people will need to have access to the system of review and publication, which now tends to serve only a rather small and very selective segment of our communities. I can imagine people, say, of course, publishing on blogs or privately over the internet, but that's not the same thing. It doesn't provide for the same entryway into the fields of discourse.
Well, I think the short answer is definitely yes, but I think it's going to take some time, and it's largely a cultural issue. That I think in order for this particular press, the Rice Press, to establish its good faith and its commitment to the most rigorous kind of review of peers, that it's likely going to work in the beginning, at least within the academies. But that doesn't rule out some of the most brilliant scientific writing and experimentation and discovery up until this last century was through what we would call amateurs.
Of course, in the sciences, astronomy, for instance, you have people even now contributing to the scientific record all the time.
Well, sure, something like the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and where there's a lot of amateurs hooked up to contributing to these enormous databases of knowledge. I think in time, yes. I think we'd have to be very careful in establishing how this is set up to make sure that everyone's comfortable with it. On the other hand, I would like nothing more than to have a brilliant new interpretation of a particular historical period or a particular series of works of art to come out from an independent scholar who's been thinking about this for years. But that's something that the board of directors for the press will need to wrestle with, I think, fairly early, because we're going to be getting a lot of inquiry about that, and also for what kind of depth we can assume for the peer review process itself. So I'm going on a bit long-winded about this, but I think it's a very important question. It's one that academe is a bit uncomfortable with, but it's something that this press will open up. Why not?
Now, moving into more speculative territory and considering more widely not only your own immediate project, but the prospect of the digital book in general, I asked a moment ago about how you plan to go about validating the text as a thing fixed in time. And this is important on a number of counts, not the least in that it leads us right to those aspects about books and reading that lie at the edge of consciousness and cause me personally to experience a certain sort of vague anxiety when I think about the existence of a text that doesn't have a tangible physical referent. For one, the physical text does, of course, fix the text in time. It essentially makes what would otherwise be a shadowy figment of the imagination into a concrete idea. a concept or a system of concepts, it allows me to point to it, to index it, and to think of it as something real existing in the real world, the same way a lamp or a slice of cheesecake exists in the real world. For instance, if I imagine myself as a young scholar publishing my first book, and I imagine that book as a wholly digital book, I know I won't really be able to take that book home as a physical thing and show it with pride to my parents. I could print it out, I suppose, using Coop and show it to them, but that wouldn't really quite do either. And I think this has to do with the fact that as an object that has started out as a purely imaginary thing assembled from experience, which has subsequently been rendered concrete and substantial, and then, moreover, duplicated into hundreds or thousands of exact copies of itself, it represents a perfect tangible symbol of the universal concept itself. So that a book is, in a way, an avatar of the truth made into something concrete. So, is there any way you think we're ever going to let go of this? Is this a matter just of habit, or could it be part of a phenomenology of sign-making and reading that we just haven't come to terms with in trying to imagine another kind of record-keeping? So my question is, do you ever find yourself thinking about this, and could it spell big trouble for your project?
Oh, sure, probably, on innumerable occasions. I would say that holding the book like that and having this let's call almost a concrete validation of a very long and often arduous period of scholarly investigation and crafting the argument, honing the argument, and here it is, something that you can hold and open at your leisure and flip through, is extremely powerful. There's no doubt about that. I also think that the power and the authority that we convey to this object, and I think you've defined it beautifully, I mean, for all the right reasons, is much more of a social and cultural construction than we probably appreciate. And I think, again, the technology is fairly straightforward, but it's these conventions that we're going to need to wrestle with and, in certain ways, try to reconstitute in a way that's acceptable and that can reestablish the authority in what amounts to a new kind of presentation of representation, which will entail a new kind of reading, different kind of reading strategies and interpolation strategies. And I'll tell you, I would like to see a lot of those conventions upended. And I think it's important. I think we are in a period now, an era where a lot of thought is being given to this. There are extraordinary opportunities that we can take advantage of if we let ourselves step out of these prevalent paradigms. You know, I keep going back to some of these academic disciplines that are genuinely constrained and compromised by the business model of printed books. And that just has to change. And if in the process new forms of scholarly communication can eventuate from these experiments, that's great. That's what we're all about. But going back to your question, your parents can, if they'd like to, go through Coop and they could get your book printed in leather. It would not be cheap, but it would be okay. So.
And finally, my last question. I wonder if you've thought of your proposal as something more than just a problem-solving venture, but as an experiment, something that, even if the results don't turn out as you hope, will tell us something about human culture in general, and certainly print culture specifically.
That's a great question, too. I think that, yes, this is an experiment. Those of us who've been sitting around and sort of putting this together and working up a business plan, which a lot of which is fairly speculative as in any startup, that everything has been really meticulously documented from the first email to, you know, I think we can do this. We've got the technology seems to be matured. There are a number of, you know, the crisis has been discussed now for over a decade, and our audience would be, I think, more susceptible to new kinds of scholarly communication, different kinds of experimentation. If it fails, I think its failure would be revelatory. And it could fail because the business model was just way off base. It could fail because scholarly societies decided that, no, this is not the time to reward this kind of publication with promotion or tenure. It could be that the interest is not there. There's a number of ways that it could fail, none of which are readily apparent, but any of which could in fact take place. So I think, you know, the best we can do is to give this a really good try. to have the financing in place. We've talked to a number of foundations that are interested in this now who would like to see it succeed. And I think that on the other hand, there may be some cracks in the business model. There may be some unexpected pitfalls up ahead. But on the other hand, those might be dealt with because of a willingness of the Academy to make this work. So it could go either way. But in either way, if this fails, there's a good book in it.
Yes, maybe so. I wonder if it'll be a digital book.
Maybe not.
Well, certainly your proposal to establish a wholly digital scholarly publishing house is a bold move on your part and the part of your institution. Momentous, one might say, with respect to the history of publishing itself. I know other academic presses have launched experiments to make certain of their printed publications available in electronic formats, but none, to my knowledge, has made the move to divorce themselves from print publishing altogether to go wholly digital in the way you have. The project must be generating keen interest on the part of publishers and scholarly associations and librarians everywhere.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting the way those terms seem to sort of trip us up. It's not a house, it's not a press, there is no press, nothing in print. I mean, it's all, but yeah, I mean, I think that, but the conversations I've had with other presses within the academic disciplines have been not only cordial, but just supportive. And I think that there's been so much discussion and so much anguish and roiling around with the issue of this crisis in academic publishing now for so long that people are more willing to listen to what amounts to a fairly radical reinvention. And the other piece of this, too, and it's a very important one, is that Rice has an advantage in the fact that its first press failed and was closed. So we don't have a legacy. We don't have migration issues. We don't have to worry about how do we balance all this, pay contracts with the printer, how do we balance the warehouse of books, our inventory, our out-of-print list. We don't have any of that. And that allows us a great deal of latitude to address this in a different way.
Well, Chuck, it's really been a pleasure. Perhaps we could come back and talk to you again at some future date, maybe in a year or so, to see how the experiment is going.
Oh, I'd love to do that. That would be great, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. It's good to reconnect.
For those of you who have just tuned in, you've been listening to a telephone interview with Charles Henry, Vice Provost and University Librarian at Rice University, also acting director of the Rice University Press, who's been talking with us about his venture to resurrect Rice University Press as the nation's first only digital academic publishing house. Next week, we'll be talking with Jeffrey Walker, professor of geology at Vassar College and editor of a new edition of the naturalist John Burroughs book, Signs and Seasons, about Burroughs, his life and work. You're listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR Independent Radio 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie.